Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. My guest today is Judah Cohen. Judah is the Director of Seasonal Forecasting at AER, a Verisk business, and a visiting scientist at the Civil Engineering Department at MIT. Judah, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Judah, your area of research is winter weather, or at least that's the area in which I'm most familiar with you, with your work. And I'm wondering if we could just start off by asking, are winters getting worse?
Well, that depends. So if you look at the temperature trend since about 1990, there's definitely a cooling trend across the eastern U.S. and a large part of northern Eurasia. If you go back further in time than that, then like back to 1960 or 1950, then just about the whole hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, is in a warming trend. So, so definitely have to qualify, that answer. And, it depends over what period you're looking at.
At least I remember from when I was young that winters in the 80s felt colder. I don't know if that was when I was just because I was young or if that was a real thing. It would seem then that winters might be getting sort of overall warmer. And I know that climate change is an important feature in any kind of modeling of the current weather trends. Am I right?
Yeah. So, yeah, again, if you go back to like 1979, which is the beginning of the satellite period when satellites were, were taking extensive we're observing extensively across the globe. Then I think it's close to not much of a trend either way. Now I'm talking about northern hemisphere land areas and in the mid latitudes. So I would say not very strong trends one way or the other. But yeah, the 1980s were, I think, there was certainly quite a notable cold winters in the 80s, but not all of them, and not all of them were in the eastern U.S. But the two standouts, were 84 and 85, and 85, 86, maybe also 1980, 81, if I remember correctly. But the ones that certainly stand out in my mind, 84, 85, and 85, 86. And then the end of the decade was kind of those winters were kind of on the milder side.
How much can we know about trends in temperature over time? Is it something that is just inherently very difficult to figure out, or is there enough information to make some kind of conclusion at all? You sound like you're just in response to the questions. It just sounds like I feel like it's tough.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think. If you limit yourself to the satellite period, then I think we could say with quite high certainty or confidence about the trends, across the northern hemisphere. There's a lot of station data, observation. Humans are sampling over good portions of the hemisphere, and the satellites are filling in the rest, but. I think once you go before that, pre 1979, when you had the satellites, then there's definitely quality issues with the data, either poor sampling or errors. So I think the community would agree with me that at least starting since 1979. We're quite confident and feel that those trends are robust. I guess is the term that we use that the errors are relatively small, compared to the variability. So,
and you have a theory about how winter weather might be getting more severe, at least on as it's experienced on the continents. Maybe if you could walk us through what the thinking is there, the logic of how the polar ice caps can affect the continents, at least in the eastern U.S.
Right. Yeah, so I'll just start by saying that most of the community, the consensus in the community is that the cold weather that we've been experiencing, some of these recently cold winters, notably cold winters, have gotten a lot of attention in the media. Certainly like this winter, this ongoing winter, but before that, 2014-15 and 2013-14, those cold winters, cold and in many cases snowy winters, was just was random, it was by chance. There's no physical reasons behind, those cold winters. Now, I, definitely in the minority and maybe a singular opinion, is that the Arctic is actually the Arctic is undergoing rapid change, and that rapid change can be contributing to colder winters here in the mid-latitude. So the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the globe, and that's so it's accelerated warming. The term that we use is Arctic amplification. A lot of that accelerated warming in the Arctic is related to sea ice melt, that as the sea ice contracts, recedes across the Arctic Ocean, that adds more and more warmth into the Arctic atmosphere. And I think that is related to kind of contributing to cold winters. And that pattern, the term I like a lot, is called warm Arctic, cold continents. And how I like to, the analogy I like to give is how maybe in our warming Arctic can lead to these colder winters, that this warming the Arctic, it's like it introduces a boulder into a stream. So when you have this warming from below, let me get back. So it's when a stream is clear, it's clean, right, from rocks or boulders, the flow is very fast and it's in one direction. Even now, if you introduce a boulder into that stream, now the flow is not just, obviously it can't go through the boulder, it has to go around it. So now you've added the stream multi-directional, it's going in more than one direction. It slows down also that stream, and so it slows it down and it goes in multi-directions. So the same thing happens in the atmosphere. So we have the jet stream, and also the term that's certainly been used a lot in the media, polar vortex. The flow, around let's say the polar vortex, which is just kind of this low pressure system that sits over the North Pole, and there's a counterclockwise flow around it. It tends to be just in a zone we call zonal, but from flows from west to east, and it's and that's the predominant flow around this polar vortex. If that warming kind of introduces high pressure or blocking into the high latitudes atmosphere, and that's analogous to that boulder. So the flow now can't just go from west to east, it has to also go north to south, because it has to get around that blocking, in the atmosphere, or in the analogy, the boulder. And when you have more north-south flow, now you have exchange of air masses. So cold air that's normally locked. So the jet stream, when the polar vortex and the jet stream, when there's very fast flow from west to east, that kind of locks up or confines the cold air over the Arctic, and it acts like a fence, or I like to use an analogy again, a dam. So it kind of dams up the cold air over the Arctic, and then the warm air resides at lower latitudes, here in the mid-latitudes where, most of the large industrial cities or industrial nations, the Northern Hemisphere are found. And so it tends to be milder, certainly relative to the Arctic. And this is all talking about wintertime. But now you have this, if you have this north-south flow of air, so you have exchange of air masses. So that warm air from the lower latitudes flows into the Arctic and, you know, warms up the Arctic. But now that cold air that was originally over the Arctic is displaced and it moves south into lower latitudes. And it's kind of like, again, you know, using that dam analogy, it's like that dam bursts and all the cold air kind of spills out or rushes out from behind this, like kind of this wall or fence that the polar vortex has put up, and, you know, and it rushes into the lower latitudes, including, you know, and it could happen in different locations at different times, but the regions that are preferential are East Asia, Europe, and the Eastern United States. And so certainly we had a good example of that, this past late December and early January, we had that kind of historical cold in the Eastern United States, where really all that cold air that's normally in the Arctic kind of just spilled out, you know, into the east of the Rockies here in the United States. And, you know, and it's kind of going on even now, but it's more in Asia. And I don't know, man, there's been some reports, you know, this extreme cold in Siberia, and that cold air is also, you know, spilling into East Asia currently.
I think when I think about some of the description you're saying there, and I've done some reading, of course, preparing for this, and I think of what the natural air mass is, kind of what the world wants to look like, is something like how I pictured Jupiter, right? So you have these bands of clouds and different air masses that sort of spinning around, staying in their lane, right? And they're probably different temperatures. God knows about Jupiter, how that works. But here you'd have colder bands and you'd have like another lane down would be a little bit warmer, a little bit warmer, a little bit warmer. And then I guess you're saying if you throw a gigantic boulder in that, those bands get disrupted and they start flowing north-south instead of east-west. What, in the case
yeah, of, I mean, I do like that analogy of the lane. Yeah, I mean, the air masses are staying in their lane. So when you have a strong polar vortex, the cold air is staying in its lane and the warm air is in its lane. Not sure then how you then describe how, you know, they switch lanes, but...
Well, they start crashing into each other, at least.
They start crashing.
But what I'm wondering is, what is the boulder, right? So, like, so the air is going, it's all going in the right direction, but what's causing him to get mixed up?
Right. Yeah, all right, so maybe with that boulder analogy, well, the lane analogy, you have a crash and you get detoured off your lane. But, so what happens is... I mean, again, I think this is not so well understood, but I think it has to do with this warming, that you get these kind of hot spots, and that acts kind of like the boulder. And so what happens is warm air is less dense or is lighter than cold air. And when you have pressure surfaces, so you have most of the atmospheric pressure is stronger, right? Right at the surface, because they have the whole atmospheric column above. And as you go higher up, you get less and less pressure. But what happens is if that air is becomes warmer, it kind of dilates and it becomes thicker in you know, the atmospheric column kind of thickens. These pressure levels, you know, dilate upwards, and that's what causes. So if you have warming from below, that causes this high pressure, this dilating of these pressure surfaces. And that acts like the boulder. So you have this high pressure sitting, over the high latitude regions, and the air just circulates clockwise around these high pressures. So you normally have low pressure over the, you know, over the North Pole, and the air is circulating counterclockwise around that low pressure, which is the, you know, the polar vortex. Now you've introduced this high pressure. And it's going counterclockwise, so the flow is, you know, is starts to take on not just a west-east. And if you would draw it and draw the, you know, kind of the circulation around these different systems, you would see that it's no longer west to east, but it's also there's a north to south component as well.
It's, you know, if there might be one kind of meteorological idea maybe that the lay folk probably don't grasp as well, and something I've certainly been learning about and makes sense once you hear about it, but you don't think about it too much, is that the air is not just one layer at the surface, right? There's all these layers that go up. And so you can think of the highway is no longer the highways we all know and love, but a 3D highway where you have different lanes on top of each other. And if you're trying to switch into the lane above you and the lane to next to you, you got to displace all those cars that were there, and they got to move up or they got to move across, and all that complexity will have knock-on effects at different lanes down the line above you or below you or next to you. And it's a complicated system. It's a 3D system. And I guess that the challenge is just trying to figure out where it all starts, maybe, right? If I remember from the papers that I read of yours, you know, I'll tell you the chain of logic that I wrote down, and you know, tell me if you think I've got it. You have this warming, which of the Earth, I guess, or at least of the Arctic, which melts some of the sea ice, which releases more moisture into the air, which then causes more snow to fall in Siberia, where it is still cold enough to snow, and that somehow initiates this displacement process of all the air masses. Because it changes the air that sits above the snow, and then that kind of pushes all the air around, and the Arctic winds up hitting into the continents. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Yeah. I didn't really talk about the snow. I mean, so most of my research has been on Siberian snow cover, and so I do think that the melting of the sea ice that tends to happen on the northwest part of Eurasia. And you have, so that causes heating in that part of the continent, causing this blocking or ridging. And then you have the snow cover, which is in Siberia or eastern part of Eurasia or eastern Asia. And that causes, so if warming causes high pressure, cooling causes low pressure, and you kind of amplify the waves in the atmosphere, if you could think about a temperature wave, right? So it has to go up because it's much warmer over northwestern Eurasia, but then it drops down because it's cold, much colder over northwest Eurasia. So you're exaggerating that kind of waves, you know, waves in the atmosphere. And the waves, amplifying or exaggerating those waves is really the key component of this, you know, this whole pathway or mechanism that I'm describing. So when you can really amplify that wave that naturally occurs sort of naturally, but if it's amplified due to less sea ice and more snow cover, that causes this disruption to the polar vortex, and it starts to wobble, and you get these multi-directional flows associated with the polar vortex, where it's not west to east, but it's also north to south as well. And, you know, even though the kind of the wave, the impetus that started this whole wave is over Eurasia, the response or the impact from it is not limited just to the Eurasian continent. It happens across the entire northern hemisphere.
It reminds me of actually, as I was doing some research for this conversation, I came across what I think might be your first paper. And one of the things that I like to do in these conversations is try and figure out kind of what's the beginning and how did you get onto this track? And what I think again is your first paper. I think this is from 91. Is July 91 is what's sitting on the top of this thing. And
that's right. That is my first.
Okay, yeah. And it's the effect of snow cover on the climate. And so snow is. Seems to me to be the common thread through all this, and you've been researching snow your whole career. Why snow?
Well, I mean, I love snow. I mean, so I had a nice enough advisor who realized that I had this passion or love for snow, and tried to, you know, encourage or at least facilitate my ability to study snow. Now that paper was just kind of looking at snow and its impact locally. So if you have snow versus no snow, what's the change in the temperatures? We looked at the energy balance of the lower atmosphere. So I wasn't looking kind of these remote impacts. So for the, you know, we were discussing is more snow in Siberia leads to a colder winter in the northeastern U.S. But this was just looking at there's more snow, you know, over Minnesota, or more snow over Siberia. Is it colder in Siberia? Is it colder, you know, colder in Minnesota? And that paper did find that it is colder when you have snow versus no snow. A lot of it has to do with the high reflectivity of the snow. I mean, I was just reading an article about snow blindness, right? That you know, if you have a lot of snow, it could, and the sun reflecting off that snow can cause a blindness, but that energy, instead of being absorbed at the surface, is reflected back out into space, and that leads to colder temperatures. So, you know, we kind of confirmed it. One of the more surprising aspects of you know, that paper was whether it didn't get as cold as people had thought. You know, like the impact was not as great. That there were these kind of these negative, what we call negative feedbacks, but kind of these offsetting or conflicting impacts or changes in the energy that didn't make it as cold as people had thought.
Well, so is it as simple as I just want to spend one more second on the beginnings here. Is it as simple as snow is kind of cool? This sort of physical stuff is just a very interesting substance. And is you know, maybe you're a kid and you, I think you might be from Massachusetts, that's where you live now. Is that all it was? And you just kind of kept on going with that when it might have been a childhood passion that got you into that? Or was there some other kind of origin story?
Yeah, I mean, exactly why, you know, my, you know, I think that love for snow was innate. I don't know exactly, but I mean, I always was struck how it, you know, really, it was the one weather phenomenon that, you know, can transform the landscape. I mean, I grew up, you know, in Brooklyn, New York, and, you know, in an urban environment. And certainly the difference that sometimes, especially from the, you know, the really big snowstorms, the two foot snowstorm, I mean, just really transformed, you know, I mean, landscape, but, you know, but certainly the urban landscape. And, you know, to me, that was very striking and something that I, you know, really looked forward to happening. But I mean, I was also, I don't know. I mean, from snow, I like to listen to weather and weather. I became very much into forecasting. So, you know, we're really talking about my research, but, I also produce, you know, involved with making a seasonal forecast. And so that, you know, so, yeah, I've certainly have got to study the snow, but also my other passion involved with, you know, with weather is trying to improve these long range forecasting. So not, you know, not tomorrow's weather, but what might the weather be, you know, again, in aggregate or an average on a longer time scale, from a month to 3 months, and maybe even, you know, to 6 months out.
How do you do that? What do you use? Is there a computer model? I would guess.
Yeah. So it's a computer model, but it's a statistical model. It's not. So most of the, certainly, you know, the governments, the, you know, the forecast centers at, you know, these government labs here in the United States, NOAA, but, you know, there are other ones across the globe, other famous ones. And there's the European Center for Meteorology and Weather Forecasting, ECMWF. It gets mentioned on the news sometimes because they also have this hurricane forecast. They famously predicted this track of you know, Hurricane Sandy before any other model did that.
Yeah, a legend has it that, well, at least that the current state of understanding is that the I guess there are two mega models. There's GFS and what we call the European model, which just starts with an E and it goes on and on and on. The acronym, I think.
Right. Yeah, ECMWF, you know, that's the acronym. But right. Yeah, so you have the two models, but there are versions of those models that are made for seasonal forecasting, and that's what most of the community relies on. These weather models that are just kind of adjusted or tweaked so they could do longer range forecasts. So the GFS is actually called the CFS when it's for seasonal forecasting. So most of the community relies on these dynamical models. But I've been sticking with a statistical based model. So certainly not as complicated, not as computationally intensive as these dynamical models. But I think it has done as well or better, you know, than these other dynamical models. And, you know, certainly historically and, you know, so far looking pretty good for this winter as well. So, but again, it's just using predictors, very simple, using certain, just a handful of predictors to try to predict this winter. So, I mean, we talked about Arctic sea ice, maybe in the Arctic influencing our weather here. There's also, we talked about Siberian snow cover. So those are two predictors that are in the model.
And, you know, I think of your work in some ways as kind of a throwback then, because statistical techniques are really just a modern version of actually what people were using, I don't know, 100 years ago. It's like, this is the way this worked last year or the year before, and so it's going to keep going like that in the future.
Yeah, no, so it is. You know, I'm writing a paper on this, actually. Yeah, it is a throwback.
Okay. Your throwback technique.
It's actually absolutely a throwback technique. So, you know, maybe back to the 80s or 90s. Two things. First of all, the dynamical models have not shown great, really haven't improved seasonal forecasting as much as people might have expected. So there's a pretty low bar to get over, or whatever.
But they must be better at something, the dynamical models.
Yeah, I mean, some people said that they are better, I've shown that it has outperformed, and I continue to have other papers to show. There have also been new statistical techniques that have improved the I actually don't incorporate it into the seasonal forecast model, but I'm experimenting with it on this kind of this 2 week to 6 week time frame. Also, I think so the dynamical models have really, when they've been built, I think the emphasis on them is to get tropical forcing, so coupling between the atmosphere and the ocean and the tropics. The most famous one of those is El Nino Southern Oscillation, or ENSO. So like we had this La Nina this past, well, we have a La Nina this winter. I think that's pretty much for certain. So the forecasts were really, the models showed warm in the eastern U.S., cold in the northwestern U.S., and that was based on this tropical forcing. So I think it's a good example of that. So that's what the models predicted, but that's not, what has happened, certainly so far. And we'll see how it ends up. But I don't think that forecast will verify very well.
Do we know why the forecast was made that way? I mean, when you ever talk about these giant models, I think of them as just kind of it's a machine that just does things for its own reason.
Well, we say in theory, they're solving these physical equations of the atmosphere. And again, this is my opinion. I'm only speaking for myself. But I do think that the models, even though they're just supposedly just purely math, purely physics, they do represent biases of the humans that build these models. And I do think that people felt that, what's most important to capture is the tropics. And didn't emphasize on other parts of the globe, let's say the tropics versus the high latitudes of the Arctic. So I do think that the models, and I've argued in papers that the models are overly sensitive to tropical forcing. So they're overly, so you put in these models, every time you put in different phases, or they have an El Nino or La Nina, these two phases or phases of the ENSO cycle, the models almost always predict what we expect to happen when this phenomenon or this oscillation in the climate system occurs. So just about every time you have a La Nina, it has warm in the east, cold in the north, southeast, and let's say cold in the northwest. And if you have an El Nino, it's just the opposite. It's warm in the northwest and cold in the southeast. They almost get that every time. And So my argument is it's overly sensitive, and I've tried to use – I do think that the Arctic is important in influencing our weather, and I think that's where the advantage – even though I'm using a much more – a cruder, more simplistic model, because it's incorporating not just tropics, I do have ENSO variability in the model, and I do think it contributed to a better forecast. But it's not limited. It's not isolated to using tropical forcing. It's also considering – this Arctic forcing, including sea ice and snow cover, which we've discussed. And I think, that's the advantage. Now, I think the dynamical models, with the models that people are using at these government forecast centers can be improved, I think. But I think they don't, if they're overly sensitive to the tropical forces, they're insensitive to the Arctic forcing. So I think that if that would be improved, these models would be better.
So what's interesting to me about that is
they room for this improvement by using the statistical model, saying, look here, you could have done gotten a better forecast had we considered, or you better, simulated, they better captured, that coupling or forcing from the high latitudes, into the Arctic atmosphere.
Maybe the right question here to ask is, what are those models designed to do? Like what problem are they supposed to solve? The number one problem for them to figure out?
Well, I mean, they're trying to forecast all weather.
All weather. So they are a general tool meant to be everything to everybody.
I mean, the problem is, there's a limit. The computer power is a limiting factor. So they can't just, compute the different, the changes in the atmosphere over like centimeters, inches, or feet. They have to do it over hundreds of miles. But they're getting better. They used to be over hundreds of miles each box that the equation was solved for. It used to be hundreds of miles, and that obviously that could resolve things like the jet stream or these very large storms that we get in the wintertime. But they couldn't resolve, they couldn't even resolve hurricanes. They certainly couldn't resolve tornadoes and thunderstorms and things like that. But now they're getting better and better, where they're starting to resolve even those features of the atmosphere. So they're used to solve all types of weather. I mean, the problem with the seasonal forecasting is, since it's being, it's being run for a very long period of time, again, you have to make a compromise or a sacrifice. So because you're running those models for longer time periods, you know, just because we're limited by our, you know, computer power, we have to make the grid boxes bigger and bigger. So even though a lot of times with the weather, we are resolving a very fine feature. So the resolving things like thunderstorms, you know, even getting down to, let's say, tornadoes, we're not there yet for seasonal forecasting.
So is there anything that's changing about the models other than compute power over time?
So I don't think, you know, so it does seem to me like seasonal forecasting has become, you know, an engineering problem where we're just trying to build, you know, faster computers and making and optimizing the equation so they run faster. And there's no real, very few advances in science. But I do think, though, that that the ideas that I, you know, I'm proposing about the importance of sea ice and snow cover on the weather. And again, for sea ice, I'm not the only one who does that. There are other people too. So I'm not, but snow cover, I've been, you know, certainly kind of one person, but there have been a few papers, more papers recently, you know, over the past few years, there seems to be more and more papers, but
what's the outcome of those papers? So you write a paper, it's very convincing. I mean, I think that certainly your forecast track record is pretty strong, and I've been following your blog, which I definitely recommend to all the listeners. It's pretty technical, but it's really interesting in that it kind of extends out different forecast time periods, and I think you do a pretty good job of interpreting what are the model outputs, but also then adding your spin on it, and I think that your forecasts are pretty good. Now, in spite of that track record, So let's just assume that track record is accepted, and they're like, "Boy, Judah got it figured out." What would they do? What would anybody do to the GFS juggernaut? I mean, can they touch it? Can they change it? Is there anything that can be done? What's the best case scenario?
Right. Well, first of all, thank you. But even though maybe I've convinced you, certainly a lot of my peers that are reviewing my papers and my proposals, you know, are certainly a lot less convinced.
But I mean, if you don't mind,
you asked me about the GFS. So yeah, I think it's a catch-22. So my ideas are based on observations. I've shown that there's a relationship in the data, this empirical relationship. You know, high snow cover in Siberia in the fall, you get colder temperatures in the eastern U.S. in the winter. You know, but people then say, okay, let's test this in the models, and then the models, you know, you put a lot of snow cover in the model, and nothing happens. So people say, well, you know, your ideas that you show in the observation doesn't hold up under the models. Now, I do think the models aren't simulating, you know, the resources, the effort hasn't been put in that the models are able to simulate what's happening, you know, over the snow cover, that coupling, you know, that discussion, right? I don't know, coupling, you know, that transfer of information, let's say, from the snow cover to the atmosphere isn't happening correctly. You know, it's like a game of telephone, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you tell somebody something and then you go further and further down the line, it gets corrupted, right? And it gets perverted, and it's not what it was. That verse is not the same as it started. So I think that's what happened. That's what happened in the models. But that, you know, that corruption of that information is being lost is happening very quickly, you know, in the model. So it's a bit of a catch-22. So I do, I mean, again, people don't agree with me, but I would argue, I'm trying to show with the season forecast that this is the case. The models are not doing a good job of simulating what happens between the snow and the atmosphere. But then people say, look, the model doesn't get it. Your ideas must be wrong.
Which is hilarious, right? Because what you're saying is the model's wrong. And they're saying, well, yeah, we'll test your ideas on the model. And it's like, well, the model says your ideas are wrong. He's like, well, the whole point is that I'm disagreeing with the model. So isn't this a little bit silly, this testing mechanism? Isn't there a better way?
Well, there isn't. I mean, well, there is the observations, but the observations are limited. There's, you know,
well, the observations are what's informing your model.
Time. What?
The observation are what are informing your model.
Right, the observation format is limited, you know.
Right,
ideally,
I see.
We have thousands and thousands of years of data that we could then build. Even my model would be more accurate. Our model that we use in AR would be more accurate if we had thousands of years rather than, you know, tens of years to build the model on. But yeah, I mean, again, it's my view. I'm not obviously going to agree with the people that are criticizing my ideas, but it's it is kind of this catch-22 where the models are imperfect, and then but. Because they're imperfect, they're not showing this relationship. But because they're not showing this relationship, then that then feeds back into my ideas, which are you know, imperfect or flawed. So, this is an ongoing debate.
We got to this point exactly in your last answer, but what can you expect to improve? Like, what does progress look like? You're just waiting around until the compute power is enough that you can decide whether, I don't know, you'd be satisfied eventually?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people need to, you know, people that are actually designing and building and improving on the models are motivated enough to say, you know what, this is a problem that we need to fix. Right. If they don't think there's a problem there, then, you know, it's not broke, don't fix it. I feel like the community felt motivated enough to say, you know what, we need to get this tropical forcing correctly, and that has been missing in the Arctic forcing. And continue, people are saying the Arctic is not important, that this is not something that we really need to focus on. Let's just keep improving on the tropics. I'm hoping, you know, with the blog, with the forecast, to show, you know, that there's something wrong, missing here, something wrong, there's something clearly wrong, and there is a path forward to improvement. I'm hoping that you know, so, you know, kind of on this, what's the word? Pilgrimage is not the word, but, I'm trying to...
journey.
proselytize, you know, I'm on this proselytizing journey, whatever, but you know, trying to convert people over, you know, and make them believers.
What is your forecast for the rest of the winter right now? How's it gone so far, and what do you think is going to happen next?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the forecast is, you know, it's a little over half over. I think it's worked out very well. You know, it's predicted cold in northern and eastern U.S., warm, mild in the southwestern U.S. You know, certainly been cold east of the Rockies. We'll see, you know, will that make it through the rest of the winter? You know, I mean, it still is, I think, an open question. I mean, I think the next couple of weeks or so, you know, I don't see anything as cold as we had, and more variable weather. Maybe, you know, it all averages out onto the mild side. I'm expecting a return of cold weather in February. I thought, you know, maybe it would come in early February. The miles are saying maybe more towards the middle of February. So that, you know, the miles that are running, like the ECMWF especially, you know, people are talking about showing a return to cold. But even the GFS, CFS, in the most recent runs has been trending colder, though it does seem to flip around quite a bit. So it's showing, you know, maybe a return to cold, you know, mid-February. And I think, you know, that would certainly take us out to the end of February, but I think it would extend even into much of March. But, you know, we'll see. Because at some point, persistence really just takes over. I think it's stronger in the summer than the winter, but even in the winter. But we're not there yet. But if we do have this turn to colder weather, you know, early to mid-February, I think there's a good probability that would then, you know, persist out, or, you know, last, you know, the rest of winter, however you want to define it, whether it's March 1st or March 21st or April 1st.
And just we should make the note that we're recording this on January 19th, 2018. So we'll certainly check and see how that pans out. Again, yeah. You know, I've always found your view of what's going to happen next to be quite enlightening.
Well, thank you.
Another kind of thought is, I'm in the insurance business and the reinsurance business, and we have clients who have business in this part of the world, in the Northeast, where we have these pretty severe weather patterns. How bad can it be? Like, what's a worst case scenario for a winter event? How long would it last? What would happen? How cold does it get? Is there snow as well? Or what do you, I mean, you can define worst in your own way there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the bar was set in 2014-15. I was, you know, pretty bad winter. I mean, it was cold, at least for let's say the northeastern U.S., New England in particular. I mean, with, you know, it was very cold and lots of snow, you know, record-breaking snow. So, I think, you know, we've had certainly the cold. We've had this very persistently, you know, extreme cold where many cities were below 20 degrees or below 32 degrees for this very extended period, you know, matching or beating, or historical records as long as they've kept records. So I think on the cold side, I think we've, this, you know, in late December, early January, it seemed just about as bad as it can be. I never say never, but I think that was pretty much shown us as far as cold. I think as far as snow this winter, we haven't seen as bad as it could be, and certainly. But again, I think maybe 2014-15 in New England, maybe 2009-10 in the Mid Atlantic, kind of showed you these upper bounds of how bad the snow can get. We haven't had a real bad ice storm, I feel like, in a while. And that would be for structure and for, insurance, that would be probably the most devastating. So I think, that potential is there, and I know in this region here, the last bad ice storm was December 2008. That was a very famous bad ice storm in Canada. I know you're from Canada.
I am.
Actually, it was the worst most expensive financial natural disaster in Canada was this ice storm in January 98. So ice storms can be very devastating, to infrastructure and cause large insurance losses. I mean, again, also flooding is always a big problem. People maybe think of that more of a summertime event, but if you had a lot of snow and then heavy rain on top of that, you can get pretty substantial flooding in the winter. Something like that happened in the winter, January 96, where there was this big East Coast snowstorm followed by a lot of rain. And there was there was extensive flooding, in the northeastern U.S. that winter. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of hazards that come with, severe winter weather. And even though the earth is warming, it's clearly in this warming trend, and I don't expect that to change, I do think there are parts of climate change, specifically Arctic change, that does increase, at least at times or for periods, increases the likelihood of severe winter weather, cold temperatures and winter storms, whether they be snowstorms or ice storms. And so I do think there is this additional risk. Again, there's parts of climate change, I think, that reduces the risk, but I think there are also parts of climate change that increase the risk, let's say to the insurance industry.
One question that's come to mind, a couple of things come to mind. I mean, one, it seems like, it feels to me anyway, like the volatility is as much of a problem as the magnitude. So it gets really cold and then it gets really warm and really cold and really warm. And that's how you get these flooding events and you get some pretty nasty activity. But one thing that I'm kind of wondering about is there any way to think about the theoretical limits of any of these weather phenomena? Like how cold can it possibly get or realistically get? I mean, obviously possibly go down to absolute zero or something like that, right? But I mean, realistically, how cold can it get in the Northeast? What would that look like, a total displacement of the Arctic air mass down here? Like as cold as it gets in Greenland, is that what we're looking at? Or is there some other way of thinking about the worst possible cold snap?
Right. So I'll answer your question. You brought up a variability, and I it's something that I'm passionate about. So most of the field does say that with climate change, we're going to see a decrease in climate and variability in temperatures anyway, that there'll be less these extreme swings or wild swings in temperature that we used to experience. I've actually argued that or showed that the variability in temperatures or these swings, bouncing from one extreme to the other, has been increasing, not decreasing, as the Arctic has rapidly or accelerated, rapidly warmed. And so that, that's another, I guess, like you said, another risk. I know with the pipes bursting, it's not just, they don't burst when it gets cold. They burst when it warms up. So that certainly there's a risk there. And obviously potholes here on the roads. I don't know if any people out there care about potholes, but certainly potholes are not so much when the temperature is persistently cold, but when you get large swings in the temperature. So I do think, again, with climate change, supposedly this temperature variability is supposed to decrease or less extreme temperature changes. But I think that's not the case, that it actually can make the argument that they will increase. And about what's the absolute cold? I mean, yeah, so we just had, this past week, I don't know if you saw in the news, there was like this Oymyakon, and this town in Siberia got to minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit or close to it.
Wow.
So that's pretty much, I think, the limit in the northern hemisphere. That's as cold as you get. But, sometimes you get what we call cross-polar flow, a Siberian Express, and that cold air is drained out from Siberia and comes into the northeastern U.S. or southeastern Canada. I mean, I think we kind of had that's what happened in December and January. That's why the air was so intense. But you're never going to, you know, it's not going to be, New York City's not going to go to down, even though Omicron got to, down to minus 90, it's never going to make it all the way to New York City. It's not going to even make it to Montreal. I mean, the air is, you know, is modified. It can't, you know, there's, it first has to go over the Arctic Ocean, which even though it's ice covered, is still warmer than the land. And even the oceans are, you know, warm and they're getting warmer. And, you know, so when the air mass is on a move, you know, it doesn't stay isolated, but it's, you know, it's mixing and this air, you know, other air masses are coming in and they're modifying it. You need a deep snow cover. The snow cover, you know, the land itself also gives off heat. So, so, you know, even though Arctic air mass can move and it can move quickly, let's say, you know, it's always going to be modified. It's not going to get to extreme levels. I mean, so I think in like New York City, you know, the coldest temperature ever recorded was minus 15 and minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, back in the 30s, either 33 or 30, February 33 or 34. I mean, it, you know, as long as I've been alive, I think like the coldest temperature in New York City has been like minus one, minus two. That seems to be like, you know, it seems to be the limit these days. I mean, New York City also has not just a matter of the temperature, you know, how cold it is upstream, right, that comes in. But it's also, there's this, it's a huge heat island. You know, the buildings give off heat all the time, and they prevent from getting really extreme cold. So you can get much colder in the suburbs of New York than in New York itself. I mean, even here in Boston, the same thing. I mean, Boston can be maybe at night it'll get down to close to zero on these really, really extremely cold nights, whereas even just, you know, within 15 miles of Boston, there are places that are getting down to minus 20 or minus 25. So, you know, the city does act as a, you know, is a big, puts a limit on how cold they can get it, you know, in the cities. But, you know, typically, you know, in the northeastern U.S. or even the midwestern U.S., you know, the coldest temperatures you get, you know, down to minus 40 Fahrenheit. And, you know, it hasn't been anything much colder than that I can remember in recent memory.
We're running out of time here. One thing I wanted to touch on, make sure we touch on, is the future, maybe the present and the future of your profession and forecasting generally. What do you think about advancing your own work, statistical work with machine learning or other kind of technology, big data processing? What's coming up next in your field?
Yes, I think that you know, so the machine learning data. Mining data is something that is being tested and explored in the field. And I'm doing that myself. I can't speak for others, but I've tried to use more machine learning to improve not only seasonal forecasting, but actually more effort on that shorter time range from, like, say, the 2 to 6 week time frame. I'm hoping on the blog, you know, at some point to introduce these forecasts of 2 to 3 week, or, well, really from 3 to 4 weeks and 5 to 6 weeks, to introduce that to the blog, you know, these forecasts, temperature at least, maybe precipitation as well, you know, using machine learning techniques.
Is it possible with those techniques to potentially, I know you also analyze, seems pretty carefully, the outputs of the climate models. Is it possible to use machine learning techniques to then modify those outputs in a kind of model like you would like to see? So I would assume that you download all this GFS output, and then you can adjust the results using some statistical technique that you'd have designed, and now you can produce kind of GSF Judah Cohen or GFS JC model. Is that something that can be done, or?
Yeah, again, and so I'm currently experimenting. Yeah, taking the model data, taking the observation data, either taking them separately or together, to see what gives you to optimize, you know, all that. It's all information. You have the model, even the model forecasts, as imperfect as they are in the data, the observational data. And again, there's also issues and imperfections with that data. With my colleagues, we're trying to optimize, taking the model data, the observational data, blend them together to give you then using these machine learning techniques to optimize that information that gives you the best possible forecast. So, you know, that's something that I'm very actively pursuing, you know, currently.
Okay, Judah, and before we go, maybe you can let the folks know where they can reach out to you, where they can read your stuff, how they can learn more about what you're up to.
Okay, so my Twitter handle, which I try to stay pretty active on, is at Judah47, J-U-D-A-H-47. I also have a blog that in the wintertime, or in the cold season anyway, I do it once a week, and that's on the AR website, www.ar.com. It's on the bottom right hand. There's a link to it, or you can, you know, Google search Judah Cohen. It'll come up right away, or Judah Cohen blog certainly will come up. You know, so those are, I think, you know, the two best ways to follow me. I've also, you know, I have research papers that, you know, I publish and try to make available, you know, on my website. And but yeah, so I'd say Twitter and certainly the blog are the best places, I think, that try to give, you know, most valuable information for most of the people that are not, you know, hardcore scientists. Though the blog, admittedly, is technical. I mean, you've read it. I'm sure you can attest to it.
You learn a lot. I'd say I learned a lot.
But all, you know, I think of some of you follow regularly, and I do think I'm giving a, you know, unique insight. Even, you know, I think I'm certainly giving a unique insight. I don't know if another product like that exists that's talking about a, kind of the seasonal forecast or the seasonal variations on a kind of a weekly time period or time scale. People that do, I think, stick with it. You can't read it once and then, you know, gain all the knowledge. But if you, people are telling me that when they read it, you know, if they read it regularly, they do learn a lot, that they're gaining a lot of knowledge. So,
well, I'm in that boat. And, you know, one of the theses of this entire podcast project of mine is that long form going deep on topics is something that is valuable out there and maybe underused. Weather output, I'm sure, is dumbed down more than anything else.
Yeah, I do have bullets at the beginning of the blog that are kind of just give the punchline I think everybody can appreciate. So,
great. My guest today is Judah Cohen. Judah, thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to today's conversation. If you enjoyed it, please leave a rating and comment in iTunes as it helps others discover the show. Go to webtrough.webtrough.com for the show notes and other content by me. And if you want to join an email list to get notified when the new episode of the Not Unreasonable podcast becomes available, you can sign up at webtrough.com/signup. Thanks again, and speak soon.